We do not have a quorum, but we're going to start testimony, and I want to remind everybody that's going to testify that we have a three-minute limit, and we've got more than 20 people signed up, and we only have an hour and a half, so that you're going to have to keep it brief. Morgan will hold up a sign that says you have 1 minute left, and we'll try to enforce that. So we're going to start with Bobby Cordano. And I think he needs the translator. She doesn't.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bobby Cordano, and I'm the Vice President of Programs at Wilder Foundation. Wilder is a nonprofit agency that assists thousands of people every year through direct service program, research, and community engagement. I'm here to thank the committee to call out some of the critical provisions you have in the omnibus bill that will help lift up and support the lives of children and our families. It has been refreshing this session to see so much education about children's mental health and the difference in the needs between children and adults with regard to supporting them with mental health services. Working with children, as we've learned this session, requires more coordination with other care providers like primary care and the other adults that care for children and their families. Our system must be designed to support the success of our children, and with this legislation, you are taking key steps toward helping us build this type of system for our children and their families in the future, especially with the clinical care consultation provisions that were authored by Representative Loeffler. Those provisions will allow reimbursement for the time that professionals communicate with other professionals in the children's life. Put simply, it helps get all the adults working with the child on the same page. It's smart, and it will prove to be cost-effective. While the children's mental health work, we focus on their whole lives, and much of our work is done in the schools. And the reason for that is that by working in the school, we increase access and we reduce disparities in health outcomes in our children. This work is partially supported right now by the School Link Mental Health Grant, and this bill includes funding for that. And we would love to see the growth of School Link Mental Health Services throughout the state and in St. Paul. Last night, Wilder hosted an event that included a play that was put on by Mixed Blood. And the play focused on poverty and its impact on children's mental health. At the end of the play, a 20-year-old woman got up and told a story and offered to come here today. And when we told her the time of this hearing, it was 10 o'clock and she had a job to do. So she wrote her testimony, something for me to share with all of you today. And so I'm going to read what she sent me this morning in a text. Hello, I'm Sandy C. Moore, and I'm a proud success story because of Wilder Children's Mental Health Services. At age 7, I was sexually and physically abused. At age 13, Wilder taught me invaluable mental and emotional coping skills. At age 16, Wilder gave me weekly therapy to combat my PTSD. It's 20 years later. I'm now a survivor who invests in young people, precisely because Wilder invested in me. Please fund Children's Mental Health Services so that we may have more success stories like mine. Thank you. Our children's mental health system in Minnesota is quite frankly in jeopardy. Too many other providers over the years have been closing due to the inability to support the cost of providing care. Please help us preserve the inroad that you've begun with this legislation and the bill. Just down the road, Wilder operates a 4-star child development center that uses a very effective and evidence-based curriculum that assures that nearly all of our lowest income children are prepared for kindergarten. On January 1st, the ability of our children to continue to attend their program has been seriously jeopardized by the lack of a medical exception in the bill and the 10-day rule. This year's flu season and prevalent medical conditions like asthma has left at least 30% of our family at risk of exceeding the 10-day limit as of today, and it's only April. As one of our parents who works in a minimum wage job testified, her son has chronic health issues, so sometimes he's not well enough to attend school. She's now close to 10 absent days, and it's only April. If she loses her child care, she'll lose her job. And if she loses her job, she'll go back on the MFIP cash grant that's only $532 a month. And if she can't live off that, and she doesn't want her family to suffer through that too. We are deeply grateful for the bipartisan support of this measure from the committee and especially for Representative Moran's leadership on behalf of children and family. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for including these important investments in children's mental health and early childhood education. We hope that you'll be able to preserve these measures as you go through the next few weeks. Thank you very much for your time and attention. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I don't see any questions, so again, we'll move next to Commissioner Ed Ellinger from the Department of Health. Welcome, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here and say a few words about our budget. And as you're aware, the department's worked with the governor in putting our budget together, and we worked hard to put together a budget that actually helps maintain our mission, which is to maintain and improve and protect the health of all Minnesotans. And we believe that we put together an appropriate budget, responsible budget for that, and I'm very appreciative of the fact that you've included all of those recommendations that we had coming from the governor in your bill. And I particularly am pleased to see that we've included three things in particular: the statewide health improvement program, funding for some of the core public health initiatives, and the home health care licensing reform, because they focus on some of the major issues that we're facing in this state. First of all, the core public health functioning. Over the last 100 years, we've added 30 years of life to our life expectancy, and 25 of those years are because of public health initiatives. So the health that we're experiencing today is really because of the investments that were made long ago by members of this body and the legislature to really focus on public health. But over the years, we've slipped in state funding for public health. And we're now down to 48th in the country in terms of state investment in public health. And that has some implications for the things that we've been able to protect the state on: infectious diseases, foodborne outbreaks, clean water, worksite wellness. And so some of that core public health functioning dollars will help to maintain those protective factors that we really need in our state. Secondly, though, we've changed from having an acute disease focus in terms of what's influencing health to chronic diseases: diabetes, heart disease, cancer, stroke. And those are issues that are really causing increasing costs in our healthcare system. And we know that we're not going to be able to treat our way out of those diseases. We really have to focus on prevention. And the Statewide Health Improvement Program, which has shown to be a very effective way of changing some of the policies and the systems, the environment that impacts chronic diseases, we're pleased that we're able to, with this budget, to go statewide again. As I go around the state, I see the need throughout the state to really have local communities addressing through best practices the chronic diseases that are impacting health care and impacting the health of their communities. So having this statewide health improvement program in this budget, I think, is really beneficial for the state and really takes us into a 21st century approach to improving health in our population. Having a great medical care system, but also a prevention-oriented public health system to go along with that, will really be what's best for the state. And finally, with the silver tsunami or the aging of our population, we really do need to look at home health care, and the licensing reforms that are there will bring us into to be able to do that much more efficiently and effectively than we've done in the past. So we really appreciate the inclusion of all those, in addition to many of the other things that were in the budget proposal from the governor. So we're here to work with you. We're here to really do our job to protect and improve the health of all Minnesotans, and we believe this budget will help do that. And finally, I understand yesterday there were some questions that were raised in testimony about the vital records, and we have staff here, so at some time in the future, at your wishes, they could come and talk to you about those vital records and some of the issues that are going on with that. But with that, I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Questions for the commissioner? I don't see any, so thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony. And we do have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order. But thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. Adele Abdul. She's not here right now, so there are people are having a little trouble driving over here today. If they show up later, we'll get to them later. Mary Krenke, Minnesota Hospital Association. Is she
here? Oh, there she is. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We represent 144 hospitals and healthcare systems statewide. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on the omnibus bill, House File 1233. As you can imagine, there are many provisions in the Health and Human Services Bill that impact hospitals. And for the record, a lot of them are good provisions. And I want to say clearly that we strongly support the MRC program and the funding for the MRC program that is included in this bill, as well as the innovations that have been made with updating our Minnesota Care program necessary for the ACA. We're very grateful for the waiver that has been extended to keep Minnesota Care in place for one more year. Obviously, there are some concerns in the bill as well. I know you've heard from some of our members about the 340B drug program, and I do have a handout today from some of our providers who received the inpatient mental health grants. Because of the weather today, they could not come, but I do have a letter from some of them today to share with you. Thank you. I'd like to spend my time that's limited today to talk about our biggest concern with the bill, and I don't think this will come as any surprise to you all, and that is the hospital surcharge that is included in the bill. We have both philosophical objections to the hospital surcharge as well as technical problems that I'd like to share with you. First, the philosophical problems and our concerns with it. And Representative Huntley stated this when he introduced the bill. There is no way to avoid it that the hospital surcharge creates winners and losers amongst the hospital community. So I think you kind of have to step back from that and say, would we take money from one hardware store and give it to another hardware store? So I think you kind of have to ask the question, is a hospital surcharge really fair to the hospital community? The second thing to note is that over time, because it is based on a percentage of your revenue, over time the hospital surcharge keeps growing and growing, but often the payback mechanism is frozen. So the hospitals continue to lose money with the hospital surcharge. I also think it's important to note that I think we have a one-time funding problem until the federal money comes with the basic health plan. So I would like to suggest to the committee that if this surcharge, which we're opposed to, does have to move forward, it should have a sunset mechanism attached to it, because we do have a one-time funding problem, not a permanent funding problem. And I'd like to just note one more thing philosophically. If you look at the funding that is included in this bill, most of it comes from either the Healthcare Access Fund or the hospital surcharge. So what we're doing is we're saying as a state that we want to tax healthcare providers and the patients that we serve instead of raising revenue through the general fund. And I think that's something we should struggle with as a state. Is that really the best way to fund needed programs? Now, from a technical standpoint, the federal government is beginning to look very skeptically at hospital surcharges and payment assessments. The Simpson-Bowles Deficit Commission had included in there a provision to eliminate hospital surcharges. President Obama in his 2013 budget did not eliminate surcharges, but reduced them and capped them. As mentioned in the bill and in Representative Huntley's presentation of this, there are problems with the upper payment limit. And for a minute here, I'm going to talk with my hands if I can. This is kind of strange, I know. But Medicare payments are here, still below hospital costs, but Medicare payments are here, and Medicaid payments are here. And that difference is commonly referred to as the upper payment limit. And we cannot extend Medicaid payments beyond the amount that Medicare would pay. So what happens in this crazy mixed up world here, what happens is as the surcharge raises the money and you try to put half of it back into the rates, we're not able to accept it. So what happens over time, the surcharge keeps collecting more money, but we can't accept the payments. So it is increasingly problematic for a couple of reasons. In the federal health care reform bill, there were cuts to Medicare. There were cuts to Medicare in the sequestration. So as there continue to be cuts in the Medicare payment, we're not going to be able to accept these Medicaid payments potentially, and then the surcharge keeps growing. So there are a lot of technical problems with how this surcharge mechanism works. I just have one other comment on this, and I know it's kind of confusing, but we have moved most of our Medicaid program into PMAP. We have very little of it left in fee-for-service. So these Medicaid rates are all on the fee-for-service side. They're not in the PMAP side. So what happens is we're trying to squeeze the money into the Medicaid rates in the fee-for-service side, and most of the hospitals have more of their Medicaid program on the PMAP side. So I know that this is a lot of complicating information, but I just want to share with the committee that there are philosophical problems with the surcharge as well as technical problems. So as this bill moves forward, we'd certainly appreciate anything you can do to get a higher target for this committee, get more money into this committee, because I don't think the hospital surcharge works very well for the hospital community. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Trinke. And are there questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Krinke, and thanks for this. This is complicated, and I feel like I'm starting to, even though I'm very tired this morning, I'm starting to understand. But one thing you said I'm not really clear about, probably a lot of what you said I'm not that clear about, but when the rates get increased and the differential between fee-for-service and PMAP, so are you saying the Medicaid rate increase does not get passed through under PMAP? Is that what you're saying? But it would under only the fee-for-service portion.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, the way the surcharge mechanism works, the way it is in Representative Huntley's bill, it has a payback of roughly half, it's a little less, but roughly half of the surcharge dollars that are collected go back into a Medicaid rate increase on the fee-for-service side. They do not go into the PMAP portion.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the testimony, Ms. Krinke. And, you know, with that testimony, Mr. Chair, are we open to considering a sunset on that surcharge after 1 year?
If the amendments are due right now. So that is a I would have to then look at what the impact is on the tails if we put a sunset on it. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Krinke. Just in looking at the putting the bill together and utilizing surcharge funds for both the HMO portion and the hospital portion, I have a question. I don't know if it's for the chair or for MMB, but one of the things that we have to do when we put budgets together, when we're looking for new revenue sources, is we have to have MMB score that somehow. When we relied upon waivers, we couldn't score the money from MMB until that we had all of the certifications and the approvals. And I'm wondering what the mechanism is for the approval through CMS for this. If we're saying that we're moving away from, as a federal policy, moving away from the upper, from hitting our head on kind of the upper limit of our surcharges here, if we're kind of getting there, close to there, how that approval comes, and what if we don't receive that approval? I understand we can still take the money internally in Minnesota, but if that does not get approved federally, will MMB allow us to score that and include it in our spreadsheet? And then what would we do moving forward? So I don't know who the right person to ask is or if this is the right time to ask that question or not, Mr. Chair.
Well, I do know that we have the fiscal note from MMB, and they have approved the dollars that we put in that section, so they have already signed off on it.
And Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering how that if we don't have federal approval, that we could not rely on waivered the approval of even kind of waivers that we were moving towards anyway to rely on that money from MMB, but we can rely on money that we have not gotten federally, and in fact we are asking the federal government to approve a policy that the Obama administration is moving away from, and if there's a backup for if that doesn't work out, or if federal dollars, if we decide that that's not a good idea, have we thought through that, and what's plan B?
All I can that I know is that MMB has approved of this, and I suppose if the federal laws change, then we would have to change what we have in our bill. But right now, it does meet federal requirements.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Lane.
Back to Mary Krinke. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually not sure if you're the one that can answer this or not, because you said that the Medicaid rate increase could not go back through PMAP, but the PMAP is a rate-setting process that occurs every year. Why couldn't it be added to the formula? And as I say, you may not be the one to answer that, but do you know?
Ms. Krinke.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lane, every health care provider contracts with the health plans, and so there would be no guarantee that the hospitals would negotiate the same payment, and that would have issues, and the health plans obviously contract with other providers as well, and the surcharge money has always traditionally it goes back into the fee-for-service. I don't know that there's a federal requirement that it has to. It just has not been the way it has historically been discussed.
Representative Lane.
Just to continue my own thought processes, couldn't we simply say to the Department of Human Services that this will go back into the plan, into the hospitals via the plans, via our PMAP formula? I don't know the answer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lane, that is a technical question that I'd probably have to check with the department on as well. So,
okay. Other questions? Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, just an observation. There's 19 people on the list, and if they all talk 3 minutes, that will be 11:30. So, I mean, I would love to. We had a very relaxed time last night, but we don't have that luxury now, Mr. Chair. So, just to put members and practically speaking. Oh.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke.
Thank you,
and
Mr.
then
Chairman.
With that, we'll move right ahead to Dr. Meeches from the Minnesota Medical Association.
While he's coming down.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just while Dr. Meeches is coming down, I just appreciate Representative Abler's comment. He's been very helpful in wanting to help us manage a committee, which I really appreciate. But I just don't want anyone to say that we're rushing things. Representative Abler, no one on the floor should complain, I hope, that this committee didn't do its due diligence and that we were rushing the bill.
Thank you, Ms.
I will say that we're the committee that has allowed the most time on the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, I will defend you if anybody says I'm
rushing. Dr. Meeches, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Meeches. I'm a physician with a specialty in internal medicine and geriatrics, but I'm here today as the Chief Executive Officer of the Minnesota Medical Association. We are the professional organization for more than 10,000 physicians and physicians in training throughout the state. The MMA, like many others that you've heard from, find some stuff in this that we really like and some stuff that are really problematic for us. So let's talk about the good stuff first. First of all, thank you for recognizing medical education and public health. We strongly support the inclusion of the restored funding for the Medical Education and Research Cost Program. The so-called MERC funding provides much-needed assistance for clinical sites to help offset additional costs associated with training students and residents, and the projected shortage of physicians and other healthcare professionals is well documented. We don't need to go into that today. That, coupled with an aging population, an expansion in the number of insured Minnesotans, MERC funding in this legislation provides a critical investment in our state and health professional workforce, so we appreciate it. We also support the comments of Commissioner Ellinger in the inclusion of expanded funding for the statewide health improvement project. If you want to reduce the cost of health care and improve health status of Minnesotans, you have to have strong public health programs. CHIP is targeted at fostering community-based programs, which will address unhealthy behaviors, tobacco, and a variety of others. So those are the good things. And now our couple
You're
of disappointments.
Out of time. Now.
Let us in there.
<That's good. laughs>
I like it.
Thank you.
Next, please.
Mr. Chair, you're as sharp as ever.
90 seconds to go. Actually, we are being kind and gentle because I was using the pros now for our disappointment. I can assure you many of our members would use stronger words and have stronger emotions. We are continually frustrated that the Health Care Access Fund continues to be used. Some would choose stronger pros. Now, by Democrats and Republicans alike, to bail out the general fund and support programs and services far beyond Minnesota Care and its original intent. This bill, in its current form, does more of the same, and I urge you to protect the integrity of the fund. That's the first one. There's only one other, and that is we are extremely troubled that the bill does not preserve the governor's recommendation to address medical assistance payment rates. As you've heard before, Minnesota physicians have had their fee-for-service rates frozen for 13 years. Some rates have seen steep cuts in this time. Our fee-for-service payment rates are 47th out of 50 in the nation. We're near the bottom. Medicaid pays most physicians 20% below Medicare rates for the same service. You simply cannot expand more coverage to Minnesotans while expecting physicians to care for them at a loss on every encounter they see a patient. Patients also suffer in the long run, and physicians are fast losing their patients with your inaction on this. I strongly urge you to restore the governor's recommendation for this part of the bill, increase fee-for-service rates to similarly address payment issues, not only in the fee-for-service, but the prepaid medical assistance program. Thanks at least for listening today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Meech's questions. I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. And I think Adele Abdul came in.
I don't.
Oh, there she is. Welcome to the committee, and we hope you can keep it to 3 minutes or less.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good morning. I have to say, just following the autism bills this year, I'm tired, so I don't know how you do with 20 million bills that you have. My name is Aidil Abdul. I have a son with autism. He is 10 years old, and he was born in Minnesota. I'm originally from Somalia, and we're not sure why, but it seems that autism seems to be higher in children born in Minnesota to Somali kids and Sweden. And Sweden at least did a study in 2008 where they said it was 4 times higher, and it was confirmed in 2010, and so the same study was confirmed. In America, it has not yet been confirmed. It's sort of just an administrative prevalence study that was done by the Palenti administration. Now, I'm here to talk about the governor's budget, which he added some money for it. And I do want to say that for some members that you were here in 2010, some maybe not, but this all sort of started in this committee with Representative Huntley, where there was a bill being introduced for private insurance, and we wanted to know, is the same coverage for low-income fee-for-service and Medicaid kids? And there were a lot of confusion, and people kept saying, yes, we pay for it, and we knew as low-income minorities, no, they did not pay for it. And so we were able to fight with a laser-like focus, and it turns out that Minnesota does not pay for ABA, therefore the governor's budget for this. I agree with a lot of the language that the governor has put in and a lot of the language that the DHS administration has put in for covering autism therapy, calling it what it is, ABA or applied behavior therapy. What I just would like is that we have to make sure that fee-for-service, as you've just heard, and managed care or prepaid medical assistance, we have to make sure that they both cover it. And we have to make sure there are policies in place to make sure that they both cover it. And I also ask that we make sure that because there is a federal law that says culturally and linguistically appropriate services must be followed by agencies that get federal funding, DHS has to have somehow come up with a way to make sure that at least that part of the standard guidelines, 4-7, is being followed. Right now, Minnesota is not. And another thing I'd like to just address is that there's always children that are low income are put in Medicaid or managed care Medicaid. I don't know if my time is up yet, but I have just one more minute. And for managed care, usually they would pay less or the services are not equal and there isn't a way to count it. And when I remember I went to legal aid about this a while back before we were able to get the stories covered through the media, and we said, well, can you help us? And they said, you know, Mr. Dole, we need to get the numbers and we need to get the parents together and we need to get the parents sue the state. I don't want parents that are low income that have children with autism to be who are already stressed and frustrated and tired and lack of sleep to figure out how to sue the state, get a lawyer. I would like a policy where the services are fair and equal from the get-go, from the gate. And finally, I do want to just kind of share something with you because a lot of people kept also telling us, well, the Affordable Care Act is going to cover ABA, and it does not. And there were a congressman from Pennsylvania, Doyle, and Senator Menendez of New Jersey wanted to add it, but we fought against it. Not that we didn't want the private insurance to cover, but what we said was, if you mandate private companies to pay for ABA, are you going to change CMS rules so that Medicaid covers for it? And we got a lot of help from the Congressional Black Caucus in Washington, D.C., and Secretary Sebelius' office, and they said no. And so as a result, the Secretary said, we think it should be up to the states. So we think we're setting a good example for this, making sure that public and private both pay at the same time for the same thing from the get-go. Thank you very much.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I will say that I agree with some of what the testifier said, and she'll be very pleased to see that we have an amendment coming through that takes the culturally sensitive training for the departments and puts it in there that has language from legal aid. My amendment will combine some of the department's changes with some of the changes that legal aid and others have recommended. One subdivision from Representative Clark's bill is in there. But we are moving ahead with insurance, and in fact, the IACC recommends both in private and public insurance to pay for it, and that is what we're moving ahead with this year.
Right.
The amendment is not perfect, and I'm warning committee members now, I'm not happy with what we're having to do. We're having to put some stipulations on it, but we are able to integrate some of the issues that were just brought up in this amendment, and we'll keep working on it. We have to stay within our budget targets in this committee, and that's putting severe restrictions on us. I also will say that Representative Huntley did help us a couple years ago have a committee hearing on this, and I do need to clarify that what we found is the state does indeed pay for ABA, and in fact, Idelson received it as an MA client. It is not billed as ABA, and we talked about that in the committee, and I just remind members, we are not allowed by federal policy to bill for bundled services. So what is billed ABA is given to the children, but it is billed as individual skills therapy, and we are asking the department, I hope it's in the language, and if not, I'll see that it is as we move forward, that we do ask the department to address that and make certain that we can bill for what we're actually providing and that it isn't couched under other titles. It just has made it confusing from the very beginning. So hopefully I'll have support for the amendment that's coming tomorrow, though it's confusing and they're working very hard to get the fiscal note for us. Thank you.
Okay, other questions? I don't see any, so thank you very much for your testimony.
May I just add one thing, and I appreciate Representative Norton's private insurance. We just ask that the private insurance language says unlimited hours for unlimited age, that governor's MA for low-income language says up to 18 with a lot of regulations that will create two-tier healthcare systems. So I want people to be cognitive of that in order to not increase any more disparity. The language stays the same, and in terms of paying for ABA, the state of Minnesota does not have the authorization to pay for applied behavior analysis from the federal government. What they do pay is skills training for only wealthier children that have fee-for-service, not for the low-income kids that have managed care. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to move on to Mary Jo George from AARP.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mary Jo George with AARP. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and we want to thank the committee for all their work on putting together this budget. We know it wasn't easy, given your difficult target. So let me start by saying that AARP is very appreciative of the critical investments that have been made for both nursing homes and home and community-based providers, including the 1.6% buyback of home and community-based services from last year. These investments are important, as we know that long-term care providers have seen repeated cuts in the last biennium, and long-term care workers are desperately in need of a wage increase. But as we prepare for the coming age wave in our state, we know additional investments are needed, and so we would love to see additional revenues if more come available in the quality improvement areas, especially in the area around home care quality, as was proposed in the governor's budget. Recently, our national AARP scorecard showed that Minnesota needs significant improvement in this area, especially in reducing hospital readmissions from home. We believe by investing in quality, it will not only improve care, but hopefully we can create some savings in the budget as well. In addition, AARP, as you know, is very supportive of the Reform 2020 initiatives, including efforts to reform our PCA program, the creation of the single point of entry for vulnerable adult reporting, and the creation of some of the transition programs for seniors who lose coverage beginning next year. And let me conclude by saying that, as you know, I have testified previously, we continue to have concerns around seniors who are losing coverage for elderly waiver beginning in 2014. And so while we did not push for additional services this year in the budget, we would urge the committee to adopt an amendment that will require the Department of Human Services to do regular reporting and monitoring on the impact of these changes. I think we made the deadline, and the good news is DHS is willing to work with us on that. And we think really the reporting is going to show us whether or not the transition programs have been adequate and whether or not the stated goal of trying to keep people in their home rather than place them in more expensive nursing home placements is successful. So, thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. George? Nope. So, again, thank you, and we'll move on to Judith Brumfeld. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Judith Brumfield, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. That is all 87 counties in Minnesota. We do appreciate the challenge that you have in meeting your budget targets set for your committee. Counties are also facing significant challenges meeting increasing citizen needs with reduced state funding over several years and increased reliance on property taxes. Unfortunately, if approved, this bill will further increase the costs to counties as a result of the cost shares, the reduced services, and the program costs. This will reduce the services that we have available to vulnerable citizens, or it will increase property taxes. The cost to counties in this biennial budget bill in reduced funding, increased charges, is just over $1.5 million. Putting that in a different context, that is only $4 million less than the entire Scott County Social Services budget for 2013. there are areas of this proposed budget bill that we support. We appreciate the proposed funding for jail health. It obviously is a good idea to draw down any federal money we can to reduce the cost to the state of Minnesota for jail health. The additional funding for the schooling mental health grant is certainly something that we strongly support. This is an evidence-based preventative service for a relatively small annual investment. We will certainly enhance the lives of both children and families in Minnesota. We commend you on the investment in technology. This will help to meet a critical need as the state moves forward to assure health care coverage for all Minnesotans. We are concerned, though, that the limited funding may not be sufficient to fully update sub-performing systems. Current investments will leverage significant federal funding that will not be available after 2015. If we don't fully update our systems, we will not be able to totally leverage the technology available in the health insurance exchange because we still will remain on some of our DOS-based systems for supporting eligibility determination. But in meeting the budget targets, we're concerned about programs not funded, reductions in current county revenue, and new cost shifts to counties. We're disappointed that the parent outreach support program is not funded. Research demonstrates that this program diverts families from the child protection system, preventing financial and emotional costs in the future. The return on investment for this program is considerable. The North Star program is a proposal that would pay huge dividends both now and in the future by allowing children to move from foster care to adoption. The outcome for children who have permanent families is much, much more positive than those children who remain in long-term foster care and age out of the foster care system. In the long run, the cost of this program to the state is much greater if we do not move forward with this initiative. More importantly, the emotional cost to these children and their future can't be quantified in dollars. The increased county cost share for Anoka and St. Peter, proposed by the governor and included in this budget proposal, will have a significant impact on our ability to serve adults with severe emotional issues. DHS acknowledges that the delay in movement to the community from the state hospital system is a result of community supports not being available. Reducing the county funding to support these individuals will only exacerbate the problem. The county concern with the governor's proposal was that the increased cost to counties was coming prior to the investment in increasing community supports. This particular budget bill actually postpones that one further year. We're concerned about that and the services not available to people. The additional issue for adults with severe and persistent mental illness is the reduction in the adult mental health grants. These are people who are served by counties who have no insurance or minimal insurance. Reducing that in order to increase the ARMS reimbursement will mean that a large number of people will no longer be able to receive county services.
Mr. Brumfield, we're going to have to...
Let me make one final point, if you don't mind. We are disappointed that the Performance Steering Committee report is not being funded in this particular bill. This is an initiative that actually came from this committee several years ago, mandating that we look at a way to make our services more transparent to the public and that we be held accountable to the public. Counties stepped up and said they were willing to do this. It is unfortunate that there's not going to be funding to move forward with this and that thousands of hours of work by community constituents, by the department, and by counties will now be another bill put on the shelf. So while we recognize the very difficult position you have with your targets, we are concerned that some of the issues in this bill will actually mean that people currently receiving services will no longer be able to receive services. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? So I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Who? Well, Representative Loeffler.
Just to that last point, Mr. Chair, I just want to say thank you because I know Judith has, on behalf of the counties, led up the performance thing, and I just want to say some of us share the disappointment, but I don't think it's going to be put on the shelf. I think there's still a commitment to holding counties accountable for performance outcomes. It's just that maybe the package to maximally design the system isn't going to be able to go forward, but some of us still think it's better to keep you accountable by outcomes and what a difference you make in someone's life than filling out lots of paperwork that absolutely no one has time to summarize or even see what's happening. And so I haven't abandoned it, and I hope you don't feel like we have abandoned the concept even if we couldn't fund the full package.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, and now we're going to Sue Abderhold.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden from NAMI, Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, yesterday you referred to the movie The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, but might I also suggest the movie Field of Dreams? NAMI actually really thought this would be the year that we'd be able to do some very large investments in our children's mental health system, and I will say that when I first heard the budget targets, I was distressed, and frankly, my heart was heavy. But Representative Huntley, you have used your magic this year. We are very, very pleased that you've included increased funding for children's schooling to mental health grants. As you know, it's an incredibly successful program that intervenes early, reduces barriers to access, and improves children's lives. Adding clinical care consultation and family psychoeducation to the MA benefit set will actually help those dollars go further because providers can bill for these activities instead of using grant funds. We have so many children in foster care who live with a mental illness that providing treatment foster care will help them access the treatment that they need. Crisis services save us money by preventing hospitalization, so we appreciate the increased funding so that we can reach more areas of the state. On the adult mental health side, in the governor's budget and in yours, we largely redistributed dollars, as you've heard, in order to address problems such as losing almost 10% of our ARMS providers and to meet the needs of people who have more complex needs in our ERTS facilities. I do worry a little bit about, you know, we certainly support moving people out of Anoka and St. Peter faster, but frankly, we have two mental health authorities pointing at each other as to who's really supposed to be responsible for developing new mental health services. Eliminating the 10% cut for low-needs people who live with mental illnesses is very much appreciated. We have so few options in our mental health system, and we were at risk of losing one more. We do appreciate having Minnesota Care be the basic health plan due to its minimal cost sharing, and that includes the model mental health benefit set. Just small suggestions I would make is to include the language related to the children and adolescent behavior health services, since the OLA report didn't actually address it in the review of state-operated services, and there is no fiscal note. And then giving a preference to schooling to mental health grant applications that are collaborating with schools that are using or have a high use of prone restraints. We really need to somehow figure out how to address that issue. I'd also ask that you make sure that the money going to fund the Wilmer ERTS is actually for the proposal created by the Southwestern County, Southwest 18, to change the purpose of that treatment center and not to continue it the way it is, because the way it is has not had maximum capacity, and these counties have worked very closely together to really address the needs in their area, and they have a large percentage of people that actually go to Anoka, and they'd like that to stop. And I'd also ask you to look more closely at the employment program under Reform 2020. It's targeted for young adults with a mental illness. Now think about this. They're going to get a letter in the mail. I don't know many 21-year-olds who open up their mail. Then they're going to ask them to call the disability linkage line, but if you have a mental illness, you don't think that you're disabled. And then if you miss a couple of appointments, you drop from the program. So that, to me, is not exactly an evidence-based practice in getting young people with mental illnesses employed. If we were allowed to dream just a little bigger, we would dream of funding for a first episode program, helping those young adults not become disabled by their mental illness. We dream of adding a COLA to community mental health workers such as behavioral health aides and CTSS programs, peer specialists, and ARMS workers. Lastly, let me just say that we don't need all of our dreams to come true this session, but we will continue to dream. And I think in the movie they said, if you build it, they will come. Well, people have come, but the system hasn't been built. I want to thank you for your efforts you've made under very difficult targets. We really greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Abderhold. Questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Bruce Nelson. And Steve Larson will be next if you want to get close to the Chair, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. And on behalf of 37,000 people with disabilities, the tens of thousands of caregivers who support them day in and day out, and the providers who make it all work for folks, I want to thank you for several things in the bill. I got to tell you that a little over a week ago, a lot of those folks I just referred to were really scared when they saw the target. And I have to reiterate what Ms. Abderholden said. You worked your magic, and we're deeply grateful. What we're grateful for is a 2% rate increase that I can assure you that around 80% of that will go right into caregivers. Unfortunately, there being so many caregivers, it doesn't go very far in each individual billfold, but just to be recognized with something is deeply appreciated, and they do appreciate that. The elimination or the buyback, the 1.67 one-time reduction, thank you. We were fearful of starting in a hole on that. You're also able to buy back part of the congregate care low need cut that came out of the 2011 session, and we appreciate that. There are a couple other things in the bill. There's 245D, and you'll hear a lot about that tomorrow. 245D will be the new regulatory section and statute, replacing 245B and bringing in other people. And we've been working hundreds and hundreds of hours with the department on that and other stakeholders, and we will have some amendments tomorrow in regards to that. Associated with that is the licensing fee, and I hope to be able to work with you, Mr. Chair, and members of the conference committee on making sure that we know what we're buying and that we can spread it as fairly as possible. We can have that discussion later. We do know that there are people who are not now licensed who will be paying fees. So we've known that for a long time. It's just a matter of fairness. And just one other point on that is fees come out of the rates. So unlike other entities, all of our money comes, or 97% of our money comes from government. And when we pay a fee, it comes out of the rates, the same rates that paid caregivers. And we want to work with you on that. And we know, you know, there has to be some changes there. So with that, I stand for questions. And again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, on behalf of a lot of people, thank you.
I don't see any questions, so thank you, Mr. Nelson, for your testimony. And next is Steve Larson.
Mr. Chair, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC Minnesota, and Kurt Rutson and I are going to get our testimony done within 3 minutes. Go, Kurt.
Mr. Chair, a member of the committee, my name is Kurt Rutson with the ARC of Minnesota. Man, I'm so tired this morning. I just finished up this morning reading a 500-page bill the ARC of Minnesota would like to share with you, the House Health and Human Services Budget Report Card. The committee gets an A for how you have supported persons with disabilities. And I thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart. We really like the Reform 2020 effort, including the Community First Services and Supports Program and Autism Early Intervention Benefit. Thank you so, so very much for the 2% COLA. I know my worker, Bob, will greatly appreciate that. And thank you for eliminating the 1.67% cut. And I just like to end in asking a vote, who loves the snow? All right. Good. Thank you so very much, you guys, and from the bottom of my heart.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members,
Mr. Larson,
every report card has an area of improvement, so we have a few ideas on how to improve the bill, even though you did an excellent job within the target that the committee had. To complete this year's effort to improve supports for children with autism, we need to adopt Representative Norton's bill on House File 181, which will be an amendment, I'm sure, that's introduced tomorrow. And thank you, Representative Norton, for your strong leadership on this issue for several years. We need to provide relief to families that struggle to support their child with disabilities in their home. And so we need to include Representative Fritz's ideas in house, in contained in House File 1156 to lower parental fees. We're very concerned about the reimbursement rates for dentists and other medical providers and the lack of access to dental care for many persons with disabilities. So we urge you to adopt the governor's recommendations in that area. And then finally, we urge you to include Representative Loeffler's bill, House File 1039, that will be the first step in raising persons with disabilities out of poverty. Like other testifiers, we are concerned about the $150 million target. We are going to continue our efforts to support you to increase that, and the ARC Minnesota will be hosting news conferences around the state next week to address this issue and to also acknowledge the efforts that this committee has made. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? So thank you very much for your testimony, and that was very moving, I must say. Eric Haughey, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Haughey with AFSCME Council 5, and I want to thank the committee for this opportunity to give input on the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill today. AFSCME Council 5 represents more than 43,000 employees across the state, from people working in the DHS central offices in St. Paul to county social workers who help people sign up and maneuver public assistance programs to frontline LPNs working in private nursing homes, hospitals, and state-run facilities, and to the staff at the sex offender programs in Moose Lake and St. Peter, to name a few. These public programs and services provide the safety net for the hardest to serve Minnesotans, and for years we've seen them eroded to the bare bones. While there's much in this bill to address, in the interest of time, I'll focus on a few key items. AFSCME is appreciative of the rate increases for nursing facilities and home and community-based services, but as I testified a couple months ago, we are hopeful we can go further, especially in the out years, as I'm sure the author of the bill would hope as well. Next, we're happy that the House adopted the governor's proposal to expand medical assistance to serve more families, and we look forward to working on efforts to continue Minnesota care through the creation of a basic health plan. We do hope more work can be done to keep premiums affordable in 2014 and beyond as well. We are supportive of the House's investment in child care with the restoration of the absent day proposal. We do wish the House could have gone further with their child care funding, but this is a meaningful proposal which we support. Finally, we're certainly supportive of the 1% base adjustments, which will hopefully help address some of the staffing needs at state-run facilities. I just want to close by saying that there are, of course, many pieces from the governor's budget proposal, which we would have liked to have seen in this bill, and we certainly understand the constraints you were under. In the last 6 weeks of the 2013 session, we hope that the legislature will continue to look at expanding their revenue options to get a final higher target so that we can truly build a budget that we would all be able to wholeheartedly support and advocate for. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Haughey. And are there questions? Well, we don't see any, so let's move on. Thank you again for your testimony, and we still have about 10 people to go. So if we could hold up on the questions, it would help us. And Corey Lloyd, take action. He's not here?
Yeah.
Okay. Rich Gerber, Teen Challenge.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And I know why you're here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Scherber. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. We're one of the Minnesota's larger residential drug rehabilitation programs in the state. We have 8 different campuses throughout the state that are licensed by the Department of Human Services to run outpatient and inpatient programs. We also run one of the largest prevention programs in Minnesota. Last year, we were in front of 50,000 junior high schools and over 150 public schools. And we offer our prevention program absolutely free of charge. We are 100% subsidized by Teen Challenge on that. Our largest and most popular program is our one-year residential drug and alcohol recovery program. We average about 400 residents in this year-long program on a given day, because individuals generally do not come into a one-year program unless they have a very serious drug and alcohol problem. We end up with some of Minnesota's most chronic addicts. The majority of these residents will tell you that it takes them months even to be fully detoxed, to comprehend living sober. Residents are under 24-hour day supervision, and our program is run very similar to that of our 28-day inpatient program. Between 6 and 8 hours of daily program are included in this one-year program, which includes classes, groups, classing, vocational training, mentoring, and other continuing care programs that help our graduates become productive and sober and contributors to society. While the majority of our clients are in our long-term program qualify for group residential housing, our long-term program is much like our short-term program. And as a matter of fact, the city of Minneapolis, when they zoned us, looked at our one-year program and said, we really aren't going to zone you as like a board and care. You are, your one-year program is a really almost identical to your licensed 28-day program. We are one of the largest long-term diversion programs that correction uses in the state. An average of about 30 to 40% of our clients are here as a diversion instead of incarceration, all for drug and alcohol-related offenses. And the courts use us because we have been a very successful model in helping. We had done 2 studies by the Wilder Foundation to look at the success of Teen Challenge. Both of them came in at near 75% success. These are some of the chronic, most chronic addicts in the state of Minnesota and have 75% success. It also showed that 58% of our addicts, or excuse me, of our graduates are going to post-secondary or college, and 77% were working 30 or more hours a week. So what that means is almost a total of 90% of our graduates are out there. They're not living in state-subsidized halfway houses or on GRA. They're contributing members of society. Because there is no funding for year-long treatment, the only government funding available for us is the group residential housing that covers our board and lodge. There are 2 different levels of this group residential housing. The base rate is $870 a month, and then there's a supplemental service rate, which is $1,260. The average monthly cost for people in our one-year program right now is $2,520. And you can do the math. Even if we had the high rate on all our bids, which we only have on about half, a little over half of our bids, we're still subsidizing people like Shelley and you meet in a minute over $1,650 a month. That's if we had high rate. And most of our beds, like we said, a lot of them are the low rate beds. Let me say again that we subsidize over $1,260 a month for everyone, even when we get the high rate. Obviously, Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge is not in the business of making any money off of our residents. We were thrilled last year when we understood that the legislature, the House, and the Senate approved a higher rate on an extra 100-some-plus beds. It was understanding that it was going to happen as a result. We budgeted in our additional services for our clients. We also opened doors for 30. We're running almost 30 to 40 more residents on any given day this year than last year at this time. And we are also opening a 60-bed GRH facility in Rochester. With this increased heroin addiction that we're seeing in the Twin City area, the demands for our program have never been greater. Most of our programs have waiting lists. We were just thrilled last year when we heard that we were going to get this funding. Longer rehabilitation programs like Teen Challenge that operate on the majority of private dollars and have a proven success need to be supported, not penalized. So, make a long story short, we realized that we had lost our
our GRH funding is not included in this bill, and it's been taken out, the higher rate. And Shelley, can you give us 30 seconds?
Okay, my name is Shelley, and I've been there 12 and a half months. I graduate this month, and I'm going from there to Missouri into school to try and help women that are being women and children that are being sex trafficked, and women with eating disorders and cutting, which usually goes together with that. And I have been in 20 state-funded treatments, and I have been in, I stopped counting detoxes at 135, and that's not counting all the halfway houses and state-funded facilities. I'm a chronic alcoholic. When I have went in, I've usually had to stay in the hospital for a few days first because I can't even go into detox because of where I'm at. I'm usually 3.7 is usually low for me. It's been up to 4.9 as far as the blood alcohol. I know for sure that I would be dead if I wasn't at Teen Challenge, and I know that most of the people there are. When we go out to sing, if Pastor Rich asks how many people would be dead or incarcerated if you were not in Teen Challenge, they all raise their hands. And like Pastor Rich said, the heroin addiction right now is, I've had two young friends in their 20s that were living in sober houses that both did heroin and died in the past 2 years. And my best friend that's never been in Teen Challenge drank herself to death. And so I know that this program works, and like Pastor Rich said also, one of the graduates now has five houses for men that he takes, and a three-story small apartment building that takes women and men in it. And so, like he said, people are going on and doing things that are going to help.
Yeah. Thank you for your support. And one last word. Almost every inebriate housing facility in Minnesota, the wet houses, get the high rate, and we're getting the low rate. So any help you can give us, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I know Representative Abler and I we're strong supporters. This is the for me, this is the toughest cut that I did in this bill.
Rick Barkle.
Mr. Chair, members
of the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varko. I'm the political director with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent about 15,000 frontline healthcare workers around the state in hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes, and I'll try to be brief. It's no surprise that we vastly prefer the governor's budget target in HHS that had about $200 million in new investments to $150 million in cuts. We believe that with the rapidly aging society, the state must invest more in HHS just to keep even. That said, we applaud your creativity, and I will echo the words magic in meeting your target. While the hospital MA surcharge is not ideal, and I would echo a lot of Mrs. Krinke's comments about it and add a worker's perspective, we have made a great deal of progress in recent years in our contract campaigns on the principle of equal work for or equal pay for equal work around the state, saying that workers at a hospital in Wyoming or Buffalo or Owatonna deserve to who do the same jobs as workers in Minneapolis and St. Paul deserve to get paid the same thing. And so to the degree that unequal funding gets built into the system, it just makes that fight that much harder. But obviously, the investments are better than cuts. And if you have to do it, you have to do it. So we thank you for that. It's not within the purview of this committee, but I would just reiterate our support for the Raise It for Health program to increase the cigarette tax to $1.50. It's good health policy, and it might help out our overall budget line. Two big thank yous. Thank you for protecting Minnesota Care. This isn't just sort of an accounting thing. We get much better bang for buck in Minnesota Care. We did, our organization, SEIU, did a lot of work at the federal level to try to get whatever flexibility we could, and we appreciate you for making that investment. Thank you for protecting the Reform 2020 investments. Those are critical if we are going to contain costs. And then finally, I would just say thank you for the 2% long-term care funding increase and for dedicating those dollars to workers. That's been a long tradition here. And we would just encourage you to listen well to Representative Fritz, who will be trying to get every last nickel she can for those hardworking folks. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Varkal? No, don't see any. So thank you very much for your test. And Nancy Selesky. Okay.
Good morning, Welcome Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Nancy Selesky, and I represent the Minnesota Inter-County Association, also known as MICA. I'm also speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, or MACSA. We've got lots of acronyms. We want to thank you for including the language in the bill relating to chemical dependency navigation. As you know, in 2009, the legislature authorized the implementation of two chemical dependency pilot projects. The two projects were created, one in Washington County, as well as one for the Region 10 counties in southeastern Minnesota. What the legislation allowed was the pilot counties to use our share of the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund in a more flexible manner. We've been able to help folks that have challenges with treatment in the area of housing supports, as well as employment and things like that. Our initial outcomes are showing that they're very positive. We have had many fewer detox situations, increased employment, and far less homelessness relative to these two projects. We brought legislation forward this year that would allow other counties to opt into this model. Since the bill was heard in the House Policy Committee, we came to an agreement with DHS on a couple of things, and Representative Mack will be offering the amendment tomorrow that encompasses that agreement. What it does is it allows the two existing pilot projects to continue, and it also allows for the creation of three additional continuum of care pilot projects, one in the metropolitan area, one in northern Minnesota or the northern region of the state, and in the southern region of the state. The legislation says that DHS will consult with MICA and MACSA to develop a process for identifying and selecting interested counties and providers who wish to participate in this. I just want to mention that DHS testified to the fact in the Senate committee that there's a zero fiscal note on this. This is strictly voluntary for counties. And finally, the agreement came as a result of countless conversations. There were, I think, 11 drafts that went back and forth between the counties and DHS. So everyone is on board on this. The second thing I just wanted to bring up is that while we recognize and support the importance of moving ahead with the ME expansion deal, as counties, we do have concern about the difficulty that we're going to be facing in having adequate resources to implement the significant increase in enrollees in a very short period of time while utilizing new technology, the exchange, and our current outdated eligibility systems. We urge you to consider one-time funding to assist counties in meeting transitional staffing needs. DHS is able to receive 90% federal participation, but counties are not receiving the same 90% for implementation. As counties, we appreciate the investment in the MA expansion and expect that it will have a significant positive impact on the families that we serve in the future, but we have to struggle to handle the increased workload, at least on a short-term basis. And with that, okay, I think I'm under 3 minutes.
Let's move on to Corey Lloyd is here now, I understand. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Corey Lloyd, and I'm from St. Paul. And thank you for hearing my testimony today. I've spent the most of my life without preventative care for several reasons beyond my control. Despite the fact I began my early 20s as a healthy young man, when I turned 22, however, my health began to change. I repeatedly developed strep throat, suffered from frequent urination, and experienced unquenchable thirst, and I knew something was wrong. Since I was uninsured, I went to a community clinic, and I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. and encouraged to start medication right away. I ended up in intensive care that night, having misdiagnosed with the wrong type of diabetes. I had type 1, late onset juvenile diabetes, and the medication type 2 I was sent home with had put me in the shock. Now I'm in my mid-30s. I work two jobs to support my girlfriend and our two kids. Neither of our jobs provide any insurance. When my girlfriend recently lost her job, she applied for medical assistance for her and our kids, and which was great. I didn't get it because I made $18,000 too much. And a year after that enrolling, I faced a tough decision. Since my seasonal job was slowing down, I didn't have enough money to pay my Minnesota Care premium and rent. I had to choose between having a home for my kids and having access to insulin. As a result, I missed one premium payment and lost my Minnesota Care coverage. This meant that I had to wait 4 months to re-enroll. During my time without Minnesota Care, I had to ration my insulin, trying to make it last, but I landed up in intensive care again because my body eventually had too much sugar in my system and I went into shock. My potassium levels spiked, I couldn't stop vomiting, and I was severely dehydrated. By not having access to insulin I could have experienced organ failure. And luckily, I emerged from the hospital stabilized with my organs unscathed. A month later, I was able to re-enroll in Minnesota Care and have access to my life-saving insulin. I need Minnesota Care. I need it in order to work, to take care of my family, and to be a productive member of society. I would like to ask to support Minnesota Care parts of the bill to keep and improve this Minnesota Care. It's a life-saving, and this program helps thousands of people like me. Finally, I would also like to ask you to try to make Minnesota Care more affordable than it is today. I had to go without Minnesota Care because I couldn't afford the monthly premiums, and I know that there's a lot of people that would end up in the same situation. You know, this wouldn't happen if it could be more affordable. And I just want to thank you for listening to me today, and I hope that you'll support Minnesota Care program, and you know, it'll help out a lot of people in Minnesota and just make it more affordable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd, for your testimony. Very moving. And we'll move on to Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I should know this with Minnesota Care, but is it the policy of the program that if one premium is missed, that they're kicked out of the program? Just
yes.
One premium?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I know they have. Is there a grace period, that, Mr. Chairman?
No. Sorry.
Who said that?
Kim Norton.
Oh no, I heard her. I'm just teasing.
We can get you that information. Dr. Ryan Daly. And after that, we'll have Troy Taubenheim.
Yep. We'll actually give you a two-for-one here. So.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Troy Taubenheim. Actually, this is Dr. Daly. And I'm the director of the Metro Minnesota Council for Graduate Medical Education, which is a council of the teaching hospitals here in the metro and surrounding areas. And we focus entirely on physician training and the area here, and work together with the programs here. And I'm here today to say thank you to the committee for supporting the Merck funding and the grants that the governor's budget has in it, and also to thank you for the additional grant program for the rural primary care effort as well. Our programs, our teaching hospitals, have a tremendous amount of physician training in the metro, which is reliant upon the Merck funding that we get. And so I thank you for that and want you to understand that that is critical to our success. We have a 65% retention rate within the state of our trainees, and that's. I'm going to turn it over to one of those trainees, Dr. Daly, and let him tell you some of his information.
Thank you. Good morning
to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Huntley and members of the committee. Again, my name is Dr. Ryan Daly. I am a critical care specialist at Mercy Hospital up in Coon Rapids. I wanted to, again, begin by thanking you all for restoring support for medical education here in Minnesota. Obviously, that's been a popular topic today, and I think universally accepted as a good thing that's happened here. I wanted to share with you today why I and many of my colleagues are choosing to stay here in Minnesota. Actually, similar to Representative Moran, I grew up in Illinois. I began my training at Southern Illinois University, and during my third year of medical school, I actually transferred to the University of Minnesota, where I joined my wife, who was beginning a pediatrics residency. She was originally from North Dakota. Following graduation from the U, I went on to internal medicine residency at HCMC. Following completion of that, I did an additional 2 years of training right there at HCMC in their critical care fellowship. And then in 2010, after interviewing throughout the state as well as in Fargo and in Grand Forks, which was my wife's hometown, we decided to stay here in the Twin Cities, and I took a position at Mercy Hospital. I think a great part of that decision was the fact that we had already established roots here in the Twin Cities. We had been here for 8 years at that time. We had purchased a home, started raising our family, we had kids, and our children had started school here, and that was a very strong impetus to us staying. And having the ability to train here in Minnesota, I think, as we've heard, is a very strong reason to stay. I think both at Mercy Hospital as well as throughout the Allina system right now, we're trying to prepare to meet the needs of both the newly insured patients that are coming in through the ACA, as well as the flood from baby boomers who are increasingly chronically ill, and will have more needs for both primary care as well as hospitalization. Allina currently has over 2,000 directly employed physicians. However, we currently have job openings for 200 physicians, and so we're trying to increase our physicians by over 10% at Allina, and I believe that this is similar in other hospital systems in the area. The reason in particular we're trying to fill positions in primary care as well as psychiatry. Further, as a personal anecdote, amongst my group of six intensivists that I work with at Mercy Hospital, two of those will be retiring probably within the next 5 to 10 years, and so even within our small group, we're going to be looking for more physicians. And so thus, keeping a very steady supply of residents and fellows in the system, and particularly here in Minnesota, is essential. Five out of the six that I work with trained here in Minnesota. So again, in conclusion, I think, you know, my wife and I are part of the 67% of physicians who decided to stay here in Minnesota upon completion of our training. 95% of the physicians at Mercy either were raised in Minnesota or trained here in Minnesota, and fully three-quarters of those physicians either went to the U for med school or did a residency program here in the state. And so clearly your funding for medical education is essential in retaining us in the state. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Daly, and we're going to have to move on because we're running out of time. But those that can stay can stay. We have one, two, three, four people left. Lena Buggs from the Welfare Rights Committee. Would you please keep it down to 3 minutes?
In the interest of time, thank you. In the interest of time, I will keep it to 2.5 minutes. So I think that would please the committee. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lena Buggs. I am here to represent the Welfare Rights Committee. I am also a resident of District 65A in St. Paul. And I'm here today to ask the committee to include our bill, House File 433, to double the MFIP grants. And as the committee is made aware of, the grants haven't been raised in 27 years. And subsequently, 70,000 Minnesotan children are living in poverty. And even if we looked at doubling the MFIP grants, it would still bring families 30% below the poverty level. Right now, families are living 70% below the poverty level. In addition to being a member of the Welfare Rights Committee, I am also a business owner myself, and I was actually on MFIP back in 1990, And back then it was a successful program. I stayed on the program for a period of 1 year, and I was able to educate myself and get off of the program. The average lifespan of the MFIT program is actually 2.5 years, where people get on the program and then they exit the program. So it is seen as a program that does help. I must say that I am shocked and I am appalled at the targets that you all have to work with. But this is the year to raise the MFIT grants. We have to, the disparity here in the state of Minnesota, it isn't Minnesota nice to sentence poor and working families to poverty. Now, there's been much ado about how much this would cost, and DHS has come up with the numbers that it would cost roughly $178 million. Which is actually below the $200-plus million that they told our committee. So if we keep the TANF dollars in TANF, we would be able to fund doubling the MFIT grants to give families a chance to succeed and give Minnesota's poor and working families a fair shake in this. And I'm here to implore the committee to please include this in the omnibus bill. I am available for questions.
Thank you for your testimony, and I think you're a perfect example of what the public doesn't understand about MFIP and welfare moms, that most of them are in there for a brief period of time, a year, year and a half, 2 years, and then they go on and become successful people in our community and pay taxes. And so thank you for your testimony, and we're going to move on now to Dr. Alice Hulbert, who couldn't make it last night, I think.
I'm sorry about that. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today instead. I'm a parent of a disabled adult, and I'm a member of a growing group of parents, stakeholders, who have children living in group homes. And our goal really is to try to maintain quality within the homes and get good value for. Thank you for the funding that you're putting in for the COLA. That is wonderful, and I want to see the money well used. In the work that I've done, I've learned that there's a substantial problem in the long-term care setting with continually increasing levels of abuse and neglect and serious injuries. And I'm handing out information right now that was taken from the Ombudsman's website for developmental disabilities and mental health that just tracks those changes over the years. My partner here is another family member, Wayne Lindholm, and he has similar concerns. And I'll just say the current regulations are for 40 hours of ongoing training for direct care staff. We believe that training is the way to get at this problem. I don't think it's a problem with licensing, and I don't think it's a problem with DHS. I think it's a problem with the way that the system is set up and the education of the staff who work there. So right now they're required 40 hours of training. The regulations that are going to come in under this omnibus bill will get rid of any hourly requirement at all and leave only a requirement training for very high-level things like the Vulnerable Adults Act that are reactive after there's been a problem. I want things that are proactive that will prevent problems. So we're hoping that you'll consider making some changes which aren't going to cost anything because they're already required to do 40 hours. We're suggesting change that to 24 hours of training a year, but have better requirements for how that the orientation training is done. Right now, there's no prescriptive thing for the orientation training. I think there is a basic level of care and feeding of humans that everyone can understand. It applies across all long-term care areas. And I think the model that you have set up in the home health care license that you've put into this same bill are excellent, and I would like to see similar things put into our area for long-term care of disabled people. I think Wayne, let me let Wayne talk a minute too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wayne Lindholm. I'm a parent and guardian of a 27-year-old daughter born with developmental disabilities who's living in an adult foster care home in Minnesota at this time. And I will truncate the message for the sake of time here, and that to piggyback on Dr. Hulbert's message to you is that our daughter went through a very unfortunate incident after a year of being in the home where she and two housemates were left outside on the doorstep for over 8 hours. The temperature was 50 degrees. It was drizzling. They weren't discovered until the third shift overnight staff showed up for their shift at 10:30 at night. So we averted a major problem, but it just reinforces the need for training. And many of these folks that are our first line advocates for the children and the young adults in these homes, they don't see a lot of staff from their organization that they work for. They may go weeks, sometimes months, without seeing somebody that's representing any type of ongoing continuing care, reinforcement, training, education. So to have the law written change to where there's no requirement of a minimum hours per year and just leave it up to the provider, I think is really sliding a step backward, especially given the history that we have here. We really need to at least maintain that. As Dr. Halpert said, they're being paid for that now, so it's not a cost issue, and to not take that away. So thank you for
Thanks.
Letting
me
Thank you speak.
Thank you for your testimony, and you know, it'll be a while before this bill gets finally finished and signed by the governor, hopefully, so we will be able to make some changes.
Thank you.
Karen McCory. Don't see her. And so then we have Laura Kramer.
Good morning, Chair and members. A few people said not last but not least. I prefer you save the best for last. So my name is Laura Kramer. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Dental Association. And I know you are aware of the reimbursement issues with the dental program. You've heard from dentists. You've heard from patients in your districts. Mr. Larson from ARC spoke about it earlier today. But it continues to be a problem in a broken program. The Department of Health has weighed in on this issue this year, reporting that 55% of third graders have cavities in Minnesota. They reported that we spend about $49 million a year on emergency room visits for dental issues. And that doesn't fix a problem. It's just providing palliative care. Also, the Office of the Legislative Auditor has weighed in on this issue this year as well. They've reported that the reimbursement rates are very inadequate and they lead to a broken program, and they recommend increases, changes in the program, among other things. And I think the reality is that if we don't act, if the state and the legislature don't take some action, things are only going to get worse. We're adding more people onto the program. The OLA reported that since 2010, when there were a number of cuts put into the program, 24% of dentists have either stopped seeing medical assistance patients or severely limited it. That's a really big number, especially when we consider that many of those dentists that are seeing patients are nearing retirement as well. I think we'll see more dental disease in our population, and that affects overall health outcomes. That makes people with diabetes have worse outcomes, heart disease, a number of things. And we're wasting more money on care in the wrong place at the wrong time. And we recognize that there are some very tough decisions before you. We do ask that you support a across-the-board fee increase for all dental providers. We support Representative Norton's efforts to, at the very least, establish the 5% fee increase that the governor had initially recommended. The bottom line is we need to start repairing the program, and we need to start somewhere. So we're asking that you at least take a step this year and continue to work with us in the future.
Thank you for your testimony. And that was the last one, so the meeting is adjourned.